Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, looking for meaning in a childhood defined by violence. We'll spend this hour with country artist and writer Allison Moorer, whose latest work is a memoir about the night her father shot and killed her mother and then himself. We'll talk with Moorer about her quest to understand what really happened and about the questions that remain unanswered. And we'll learn how Moorer came to terms with the fact that the most formative event of her life is a tragedy. Our conversation starts after a short break. Was 4 or 5, she found a way to fall asleep at night when she was really scared. 7 words, spoken over and over until she grew calm or drowsy. Please, God, don't let Daddy hurt Mama. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The prayer didn't always work, but at least when she woke up, her mother was there. Until one morning before dawn, when the litany failed altogether. 2 gunshots jolted Moorer awake. Her father had killed her mother and then himself. Allison Moorer was 14 then. Today she's 47. She has spent decades trying to understand how it could have happened and to grapple with what it means that someone she loved caused the worst thing that has ever happened to her family. As a musician, Allison Moorer has been nominated for Academy, Grammy, Americana Music Association, and Academy of Country Music Awards. Her new memoir is called Blood. Allison, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
As you've moved over the years, you've always taken along a hat that belonged to your father. And for a while, you kept it where you couldn't easily see it. And now you've hung it up in your bedroom where you do see it all the time. What do you think about when you look at it?
I had the hat hanging on the back of my closet door in my bedroom until just recently. I moved from New York City in May of this year, back down to Nashville, where I had lived for many years. I spent 14 years in New York City, and while I was writing Blood, I lived there. I hung it on the door, I think, because it was time for me to see it every day. It was important for me to see, especially during the writing of this book. What did I think? I think that some days I didn't necessarily see it. And some days I saw it very clearly.
Yeah.
And some days it was too much for me to see.
You realize, have come to realize, that your parents will remain two of the most influential people in your life forever. And you feel like they deserve to be remembered beyond the terrible way they died. So I would love for you to tell us about your mother. For starters, you write that she was one of the funniest people you'd ever known. What was her sense of humor like?
Goofy. She just had, she's just a funny person. You know, some people are funny and some people are not by nature. And I think that she had a lighthearted personality. She liked to have fun. She liked simple things. She liked simple pleasures and could make a good time in most of the situations she found herself in, whatever they were. And I think that's the mark of a successful person. And by that, I mean someone who can walk through the world successfully and handle it. Mm-hmm. I think it's a coping mechanism. I think it's, for her, it was definitely a coping mechanism. She was just funny. She just, things she did were funny. Things she said were funny. I just remember her as being a humorous person.
How did your parents get together?
They were introduced by my mama's sister, who was a high school student at the school where my daddy taught English. And she, for some reason, had the feeling that my mama was older than she was, so she had gone to the same high school, but she was out of school by the time that my Aunt Jane was a senior and was a student in my daddy's study hall period. So she devised the scheme involving some papers that she purposefully left in my mama's car, and she called my mama at work and said, "You've got to bring these papers to me during this time that I'm in the study hall, and you have to bring them in. You can't leave them in the office. I can't come get them. You have to bring them in to me." Why my mama fell for this, I have no idea, but she did. And that's how they met.
Did they love each other?
Absolutely.
What do you think drew your mother to your father?
Well, that's one of the things that I don't know. Beyond sort of the surface parts of that, he was very handsome. He was charismatic, smart, talented. I think very different from most of the people that she knew. That's all I have to go on. One of the things that bothers me about growing up with them as parents is I hardly ever saw them be loving toward each other. So I think there was a certain point where that sort of went away, if it was ever present. I have a feeling that my father was always difficult. But by the time I came along and began to notice things, I think he had become a different person than he had been when he was younger. And I don't know why.
So he had a volatile temper. He had a drinking problem. He was employed and unemployed off and on. Do you think he was mentally ill?
If I were going to bet, I would say yes. I'm not a professional in that area, mm-hmm. So there's no way I can say this is what I think it was. He was an alcoholic, without a doubt. He had a volatile temper. What his specific problem was, I don't know.
Does it make a difference? If there were a diagnosis, would that make a difference to you?
I think it would be easier to figure out what happened. And I think it would be easier to come to a place of forgiveness if he had had a diagnosis of some sort of mental illness. But again, who knows what that diagnosis would have been.
You have some samples of songs that your father was working on, and your take on them is that he was okay as a musician, but not great. So what is it that allows you to see that he was okay as a songwriter, but not a brilliant songwriter?
What is it that makes me say that?
Yeah, like what do you see and not see in the songs?
Well, who can say what makes something great and good? Mm-hmm. That's just my personal take. I am a songwriter by trade. I've spent 25 years writing songs in Nashville, so I have gotten the opportunity to sit at the feet at some of the masters, and I know that he was not one of those.
Do you think he understood the limits of his own talent?
I think that he did, and I think it was very frustrating for him that he could not be brilliant at music. I think that he was a talented person and he had an artistic bent. He was very creative. He was a person who made things. He, you know, when I think about our home when I was growing up in Frankville, Alabama, you know, he always would do all the work if we needed a repair or if, I don't know, let's just say someone wanted a table. Well, he could go out to his workshop and make it. He was, at one time, he taught high school shop. His last job was working at a vocational school as sort of a overseer of the school. He was in charge of helping to grow the crops to make sure the school turned a profit. And he could do many things. He was very talented. He was well-rounded in the things that he could do. I think that it was frustrating for him that he could not excel at the thing that seemed to fulfill him, which was music.
Because your mother was a natural.
She was very talented. Now, Mama grew up in a musical household. Her mother was one of 14 children. She was born in 1926, which, of course, is the height of the Great Depression. And they lived in South Alabama and didn't have very much at all. My grandmother says that she's my one remaining grandparent. She's 93 now. And she will say that, you know, their house burned when she was very young. And she said the things that they made sure they got out of the house were the records and the guitar. Those were the things that were their prized possessions. So my mama grew up in an environment where it was not unusual for people to just gather and sing. They all of my grandmother's brothers and sisters, for the most part, still lived nearby. So they my grandmother would have what she called fiddlings, which was on a Friday or Saturday night. Everybody would get together. Most of them could play and sing a little bit. And it was just a thing that they did for the joy of doing it. No one ever really had big designs on taking it farther than that, although they would organize groups for this or that event around where they lived. And they sang in the church. And, you know, the saying was, those doll bears, doll bear is my grandmother's maiden name, could sing. And it's funny, since this book has come out, I've had some people come to shows. And I met a man recently in Houston who told me that he had known both my mama and my daddy. Wow. He had played in a band with my daddy. He had a crush on my mama. And he said everybody knew that those doll bears could sing. And I just find that hilarious. So what I'm getting to is I think my mama had an advantage that my daddy did not have, because he didn't grow up in a household where there was always music going. And people weren't singing all the time. He was taught to play guitar by a childhood friend of his, and then he just took it and ran with it. So on one hand, he probably worked harder at being good at music, but my mama had such early exposure and such constant exposure that she, you know, developed a stronger ear. She could sing harmony. She just had a natural talent for hearing that he did not seem to have.
Did you and your sister, growing up surrounded by so much music and people who prized music, did you realize that you had a particular talent, or did it just seem like something that everybody did that you knew?
It was not odd to me at all that we sang, because I don't remember a time in my life when we didn't sing. From the time I was about 3 years old, I could sing harmony. And I think that was because I was around it all the time. And I write about this in this book. We lived way far out in the woods. So that meant that we had to drive at least 30 minutes each way to get to town so that my mama could go to her job and my sister and I could go to school. At one time, we had a car that had no working radio. So she would teach us songs. And this was when I was very small. So we learned how to harmonize in that car and beyond, you know, because we were always at my grandmother's and there were always people around doing that thing. My grandmother tells me that in 1976, it was probably right before my fourth birthday, she and two of her nieces and my mama and her brother Clyde had formed a singing group to play at the bicentennial celebration. And they, you know, made costumes and the whole thing. And they were doing these old tunes, like barbershop sorts of tunes that involve a lot of harmony parts. And they were doing this song called Heart of My Heart. And I was hanging out around the piano, just sort of on the floor doing little kid things or whatever I was doing. But she said, when they got done with the song, I crawled out from under the piano and in a perfect chromatic scale just piped up and went, Heart of My Heart. And they went, oh no, this one's ruined already.
My guest is writer and musician Allison Moore. Her new memoir is called Blood. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
I paid the
coast.
Time has made me see just how much I lost.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That is my guest, Alison Moore, singing I'm the One to Blame. We're talking today about her new memoir called Blood. What is the story of that song, Alison?
The story of I'm the One to Blame is very shortly after our parents died, my sister was going through an old briefcase that had belonged to our daddy. And it was full of songs, papers, this and that, letter of recommendation, you know, all kinds of stuff. And she found the lyric to this song, I'm the One to Blame. Neither of us were familiar with the song. We had never heard it, and we didn't know what the music was. So my sister wrote a melody for it, and that's what you hear. His words, her music, my singing.
Do you feel at all like you're inside his head when you sing those lyrics?
I think it's the closest look that we can get at some serious personal inventory. And it seems like this lyric was written in a remorseful moment, and I have no idea what drove it. I have no idea what caused him to write this song. It's something that I would love to know. I'll never know, but I would love to know it. I think it's a window to a part of him that we did not see. When our father was remorseful when we were children, it was in a petulant way. And I'm very aware that what I saw was someone who had been very damaged by alcoholism. And what I know about addiction now that I couldn't know then is that it just wrecks you spiritually and at a soul level. So I have to consider that as well when I think of him. And it makes me very sad that he was saddled with what he was saddled with.
You realize now that when you were a girl, you held your father simultaneously in awe and in contempt. What did you do to try and please him?
Everything, anything. Children want to please their parents. Mm-hmm. That's a given. That's a primitive impulse. We don't want them to leave us behind. So we try to do everything we can do to make sure they like us. And I think when affection is withheld for whatever reason, it makes it that much more of a goal. I'm going to earn this affection. I'm going to earn praise. I'm going to do everything right so that I can gain this person's approval. I remember feeling like that when I was a little girl. Like, what do I have to do to make him happy? What do I have to do in order to be safe and have some peace? We don't know when we're children that we're not in charge of that, and it doesn't really have anything to do with us at all.
Do you think he understood that you were afraid of him?
I don't know. I don't know. I don't know that he had enough generalized self-awareness. Because again, we're talking about someone who was very often drunk. I really don't know how often I saw him sober. I can't know. Common sense would say, well, during the day, in the morning, he was probably not drunk. Oh, I don't know that. I don't know that. I don't know really what he was doing. I know that he kept whiskey in the toolbox of his truck. I don't, I remember, you know, when I write about this in the book, I remember when I was in sort of preteen years, waking up and seeing him stand at the refrigerator and down a beer at about 4 a.m. So it got to that point when I was that age that I was seeing things like that happen, and I just don't know how long it had been to that extent. So I really can't say if I really can't say that I have a real clear picture of who he was without alcohol.
You share a memory of your father hurting your sister, your older sister, when she was still a very little girl herself, like maybe 7 or 8, and she was blamed for an accident that you had. I mean, you know, just as everybody listening must know, that it couldn't possibly have been your fault. How did you learn to stop blaming yourself for that?
I don't know that I have.
Did the two of you talk about what it was like to grow up in that house when you were in the house?
So many of the conversations that I have with my sister about our childhood, there's such an there's so much of it that can only be felt and not spoken. And one of the most amazing things in my life is having my sister as my sister. One of the things that makes having her as my sister amazing is that we have bonds that go beyond a regular sibling bond. That's a strong bond to begin with, but we have a trauma bond that is very strong. We both maintain that there is no other person on the planet who can wrap their head around what we went through. In some ways, I'm her memory, and in some ways, she is mine. It's a very powerful thing to share a memory, even if our experiences are somewhat different. And that's a whole nother subject that I could go on and on about, just the concept of growing up in the same house and having really different sorts of homes in your heart. We don't talk about specifics very much unless there's some story one of us is trying to remember or recount or whatever it is. But what we do is often feel the feeling of it with almost no dialogue at all. And how that happens is just some sort of magic, some sort of telepathy, some sort of soul conversation that we have together that is one of my treasures.
At one point, you found a collection of things like near your mother's side of the bed that you realized she could use as a weapon of self-defense if your father was hurting her, candlesticks and things like that. Did you realize in the moment that that's what they were for, or did you realize years later?
Well, no, I was not the one who found those things. But it was my sister told me that there were several things found by her side of the bed, like this huge candlestick, a couple of items that a person could use to fight off another person or someone who was, or something that was trying to harm them. In what that says to me is that she was often in situations that she had to fight her way out of. That says to me that no one knew the extent of unhealthiness and danger in their relationship.
She told you not to tell people about it, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When my sister and I would go off to our grandparents' house or even, school or friends, we were not to say anything about daddy's drinking. We were not to say anything about their fighting. We, you know, we weren't allowed to bring friends home. First of all, we lived too far away from town, but our house was always in disrepair. Or mama was just scared that he would come home at 2 a.m. and be in some sort of rage. So it was, we had to keep a lot of secrets and we had to keep our doors closed to the outside world because there's no way that we could have exposed anyone to what was really going on.
Not long before she died, your mother did leave your father. And I hope that you'll forgive me for asking a simplistic question that I know always has a complicated answer and that nobody can answer unless they've been in that situation. But I think people may be wondering, what made it hard for your mother to leave your father earlier than she did?
He was a master manipulator. He would do, you know, there was a lot of sort of yo-yo stuff going on when I was a girl. A couple of times, my mama decided she would leave. And we would load up the car with all our stuff, and we'd go to her parents or some friends or whatever it was. But daddy would always show up, and he would somehow talk her into going back. So, and how he did that, I don't know. I wasn't privy to the conversations, but we would always end up going back. And things would smooth out for a little bit, and then they'd just go back to the way they had been before.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. You write about wearing yourself out with what ifs. What kinds of questions can you get stuck on, and have you found some way to outrun them when they start spinning around in your brain?
Well, one of my main what ifs, and I probably think about this every day still, this far down the line, 33 years later, on the morning that my parents died, we were living away from my daddy. My mama had moved out. He showed up at the house where we were living, probably, you know, in the wee hours. It was probably 3:30, something like that. I don't know. It was dark outside. I was sleeping in the living room because my mama's friend had stayed over and slept in my bed because she had been with us the night before. Daddy kept calling. It was scary. They were both scared about what he might do. So he did come. When he did come to the house, I woke up and opened my eyes and saw him standing in the kitchen. Now, it wasn't unusual for him to come over. Mama let him come over, and he was always sort of hanging around between, you know, after we moved out and we were living separately from him. Mm-hmm. To my knowledge, he'd never been over at 3:30 in the morning before. I woke up, and I saw him standing in the kitchen, and I saw her standing in the kitchen as well. Just her would have been her right side. She was standing at the counter making a pot of coffee. I asked myself all the time, what would have happened if I had gotten up? When I woke up and saw him, what would have happened if I'd gotten up instead of going back to sleep? Who can say? And things happen the way they happen, I have to believe, for some sort of reason. But I ask myself that a lot.
A few years ago, you sent away for, I guess, their autopsy reports. What did you think you might learn from those documents that you didn't already know about what happened that night?
I think that I had always entertained different scenarios about what could have happened. As I say in my book, it did not surprise me when Daddy committed suicide, because I think I always thought that he would do that. It just didn't surprise me. That he took my mama's life is something that I've tried to figure out. You know, does it matter? No. I always thought maybe it was an accident. Could the rifle have fallen and then accidentally gone off? What happened? Who went first? How did this happen? What in the world? And I had never seen the autopsy reports in all of those years. And I got to a point in the writing of this book where I felt like I needed some concrete information about what could have happened, because I had worked up in my mind several scenarios. You know, he shot himself, the gun fell, then it went off and hit her. Well, no, that probably wouldn't have happened. It was a .30-06 hunting rifle. It's just not really probably going to happen that way. I wanted to see the details, and it was, who can say why we do the things we do? Yeah. Sometimes we just do things. And I'm a person who wants the information. I want all the information I can get about whatever it is I'm trying to learn about so that I can go through it and work it up on my own and try to sort it out in my mind. And I think that's what I was doing. I wanted to know what happened as well as I could know it. Now, I don't think that anyone could look at the autopsy reports or the lab results or any of that and tell what exactly the choreography of it was. But my mama did have a bad bruise on her arm, which indicated to me that she had been handled, either pulled outside by him or so that's a possibility. Or she went outside with him to try to stop him from hurting himself, and he had the rifle, and maybe she tried to get it away from him, and then he grabbed her, whatever. Who can say? But I needed to try to put some of these possibilities to rest in my mind, because it was just not easy to wrap my mind around without it.
My guest is Allison Moore. We're talking about her new memoir, Blood. We'll be right back.
A slave to the bottle, he driven his family.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. That is my guest, Grammy-nominated musician Allison Moore, who's written a new memoir called Blood. Allison, that song obviously refers to your parents. It was recorded, I think, in 2000. Is that right?
In 1999.
Okay.
For the first time. I included it on my second album, which was called The Hardest Part, as a hidden track.
So were you, I mean, did people know your story? Was it sort of widely known that this had anything to do with real life for you?
Well, this story has been out in the public since it happened. Mm-hmm. It was in the Mobile paper, which I never saw until I was in college. And in one of my journalism classes, I learned how to find something in an old newspaper. Mm-hmm. And so I went and found it. My sister moved to Nashville in 1988, so about a year and a half after our parents died. And she was pursuing a career in music and was signed to a record deal. Her first album came out in 1989 when she had just turned 21, I think. And she didn't let the story out until I think right before her second album came out. And then it was everywhere. So this story hangs around us in pretty much everything that's been written about either one of us. It has been mentioned. So it's never been a secret. Now, both of us have really sort of declined to talk about it. And for some reason, that's been hard for people to figure out. I think that we both have been at times considered difficult because we didn't want to discuss this event in interviews that were supposed to be about our music.
Yeah.
And why that's lost in people, I don't really know. But as a result of that, because there were very few details out there about it, it would get printed and it was just always this footnote or sometimes even the lead in the press that surrounded both of our careers. One of my goals with writing this book was to present them as I remembered them, not as these two tragic figures who could only be remembered by the worst thing that ever happened to both of them.
So you and your sister have both had a lot of success. And as you said, the story has sort of followed you even when you didn't invite it. I'm curious, though, I would imagine your entire life since you were 14, you have met casual acquaintances, people who ask the sort of normal questions about what's your family like, what do your parents do, not realizing because they didn't know anything about it that this would be a really complicated thing for you to answer. How have you decided one way or another to sort of reveal the whole truth or give an easy answer that keeps you from having to go into this with people you don't really know?
It depends on the situation, but I hate to see that question coming at me when I'm at a dinner party with people that I don't know well, or in sort of what we consider to be polite conversation. I call it peeling back the onion when you're getting to know someone. Inevitably, the questions will always go to, well, where are you from? What about your family? Are your parents still alive? Do you have, all these questions about trying to figure out who a person is?
Yeah.
Hardly anyone ever expects to be met with, my parents died in a murder-suicide. Now, I have just sometimes, first of all, I can't lie.
Right.
So
right.
I can't make up some story. I probably have had moments when I wish that I could do that, but I haven't done it. I have. I've been through times in my life when I was very guarded about it. I didn't want to talk about it. I didn't feel like I wanted to reveal such details about myself because there are two things that happen when I do reveal it. The first thing is, oh, and then the conversation ends because they're so horrified or embarrassed by having stepped into such a mud hole that they stop talking to me.
Yeah.
And then I feel guilty and badly about having brought them down.
So then it's all about them, you having to comfort them.
Yeah, it can become that. Or the other thing that can happen is, wow, well, what was that like? Well, how did you survive? Well, how did that? And it's not always something sort of like the same situation that I would be in trying to do an interview and a journalist would want to go down that road. And just, well, to have to talk about what it was in a removed way is not always possible. So I have definitely experienced myself becoming reticent at times or withdrawn at times because, or just feeling shy because I didn't want to get into that sort of conversation with people. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. And I'm thinking, sitting here, obviously you've written about this. You've decided to tell your own story. You're willing to talk about it. But I have to imagine I'm asking you some of the same kinds of invasive questions that you avoided in the past.
Absolutely right. But the difference is this time I signed up for it and I knew exactly what I was doing. And I knew that I would have to talk about it. Now, that doesn't make it easy every day.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, talking about this book has been difficult for me at times. And, you know, not so much that I'm falling apart in every interview, but I also know it's a fine line because I also know that in order to answer the questions in a heartfelt and articulate way, I've got to really be in there. So I can't sit here and talk to you and just be sort of filing my nails and going, yeah, yeah, it was this, it was that. I got to get in there with you. And I want to get in there with you. I would not have done this work. Well, maybe I would have done the work, but I wouldn't have put it out in the world mm-hmm. if I was going to then say, well, nope, you can't ask me about that. And this happened 33 years ago. It makes it that period of time having gone by makes this not in no way less painful, but I do have enough distance from it to see it in a different way than I did, let's just say, 10 years after it happened or even 15 years after it happened. When my first record came out in 1998, it had only been 12 years. I was still a very young woman.
Mm-hmm.
I was 26 years old. A 26-year-old orphan who had been an orphan for, you know, almost half of her life. And I was still very raw. I hadn't processed it. I hadn't learned enough. I had not gotten perspective. And I will tell you this, becoming a parent myself gave me a perspective on my parents that I would not have otherwise had.
Like what?
Empathy. Being in a marriage myself gives me empathy for my parents because I know how hard it is to have a successful relationship, especially if you've got trauma that is unresolved, if you have issues that you have not been able to look into, if you're struggling with addiction on either side, relationships are difficult. It's difficult to have a successful marriage. And because I know that, I consider what my parents went through and just how they sort of struggled to get along through that sea of alcohol and dysfunction and unresolved issues. And who knows what traumatic experiences both of them had. My mother was married before she married my daddy to a man who reportedly abused her. So she was carrying that into her relationship with my daddy. My daddy's upbringing, I think, had some difficulty in it, although I don't know any specifics. I remember just sort of an air of heaviness around his relationship with his parents. And I don't know where that came from. I don't know any of the story. But I know that every family has dysfunction. So when you're bringing all that sort of material into a relationship, it's a wonder anybody can survive it, much less thrive in it. So when I think about them and I think about the full spectrum of who they were and what I knew about their relationship, I think, you know, a lot of couples struggle in the way that they struggled. And my story is not all that different from a lot of people's stories. What makes this story extraordinary is the way that it ended for them. And I realized that. I think the reason that people can relate to a lot of what this book is about is because it isn't that uncommon to grow up with struggling parents.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. After you heard the gunshots that morning, you, of course, called out for your mother, and in hindsight, you hope she didn't hear you. Why is that?
After I heard the gunshots, I was frozen for, I don't know if it was 5 seconds, I don't know if it was 5 minutes. But I do remember getting up off the floor, walking toward the kitchen door, opening it, and calling for my mama. Even though I knew in some fragmented part of me that what I had heard was a gun, And there was also some part of me that knew exactly what had happened.
Mm-hmm.
You still, you know, it feels like these little pieces of you break off when you're trying to survive what is a shocking, horrific situation. It's amazing what our brains do to protect us. I walked to the door. I opened it. I stuck my head out the door. It was still dark. I did not look in the direction where they were. And again, it's like I had this sense of, nope, don't look over there. You can't handle that. Look straight ahead and just call her. And when she didn't answer, I just backed up and went back in the house. I didn't go into the yard because I had this sense of, yeah, I know what's happened and I just can't handle that. When I say that, I hope she didn't hear me. I hope that the last thing she was aware of was not that I was calling for her and she couldn't get to me. As a mother, one of my greatest fears is not being able to get to my son.
Yeah.
Or something happening to me. And I think that would be excruciating.
Musician and writer Alison Moore has been nominated for Academy, Grammy, Americana Music Association, and Academy of Country Music Awards. Her new book is called Blood, a memoir. Alison, it's strange to say it's a beautiful book, but it's so beautifully written, and I really am grateful to you for your candor and for sharing this story with us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks to all of you who are listening today. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is @KERAThink. If you'd like to subscribe to our podcast, you can do that wherever you get your podcasts. And you can learn about upcoming shows we have planned at think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.